the size of a sedan. Apparently he's got good credit. Bell doesn't have any cards, however, and there are tendrils beyond the space he's cleared, and now Manny's only got the debit card left. How much money is in his bank account? He can't remember. Okay, says the woman with satisfaction. Manny is stunned to realize he forgot her for a moment. She smiles at them from amidst the thickest knot of gently waving tentacles, her head and shoulders now festooned with at least a dozen. The police say they're on their way. You people may have been able to get away with doing drugs or blowing each other in broad daylight before, but I didn't move here to put up with stuff like that. We're gonna get you out, one by one. Manny's consternation about Manhattan real estate prices is eclipsed by sudden, dry-mouthed fear. If the police do show up, which isn't a guarantee, even as a newcomer, he can tell Inwood is still too brown a neighborhood for a definitive or quick response, especially during a citywide emergency. They will walk right into the rapidly growing field of white tendrils that now surrounds Manny and Belle. And if one tendril has turned a nosy, racist white woman into a conduit for disembodied existential evil, he doesn't want to see what infected NYPD will become. He's getting ready to throw the debit card, and hoping desperately that that account just happens to contain $1 million or so, when they hear another cell phone. New York, New York, big city of dreams. It's mostly a gabble of tinny sound from this distance, probably an iPhone, but from the gabble, Manny can make out hand claps over a beat, electronic drums, and a record scratch? Like in old school rap? Too much, too many people, too much. Manny whips around to see a middle-toned black woman coming toward them on a path that converges with the Shirakapuk clearing. She's tall and strong, with an upright carriage and thighs that are nothing but curve, the latter accentuated further by the pencil skirt she's wearing the hell out of. Some of her bearing comes from all this style, plus smart heels and an elegantly texturized honey blonde dyed cap of curls. But most of it's just her. She's a presence. She looks like either a CEO on her way to an incredibly stylish meeting, or a queen who just happens to be missing her court. Then Manny sees that she's also holding up a cell phone. Instead of filming, however, she's using this one to blare music. The song is a little before Manny's time, but he's heard it once or twice, and ah. With every tinny beat of the synthesized drums, the field of tendrils that has filled the tulip tree rock clearing begins to twitch en masse. As Manny inhales in relief, the woman steps onto the cobbles, and the tendrils flinch away from the brisk click of her heels. The ones she steps on actually scream in tiny, hissing squeaks as they writhe and then vanish. When she directs the phone downward, the ones that haven't already withdrawn shudder, as if each beat is a painful blow. Then they crumble away, leaving no residue or sign that they were ever there. The tendrils are crumbling away everywhere. Too much, too many people, too much. Yes, the city might welcome newcomers like Manny, but mind-controlling, parasitic, otherworldly entities are the rudest of tourists. Five of us, Manny murmurs. He knows who, or at least what, this woman is. Belle throws a look at him, then shakes his head. Fran, I sincerely hope you drink. I'm gonna need something potent and extremely fruity after this. Manny laughs, as much to release pent adrenaline as anything else. By the time the chorus ends, the tendrils are gone, and the clearing is as it was before. Trees, grass, asphalt, a lamppost, a rock, and Bell and Manny crouched to defend themselves against, now, nothing. Even the tendrils on the neck and shoulders of the white woman have vanished, and she now stares at all of them, especially the black woman, with rising alarm. But she's still filming. Manny and Bell turn to the black woman, who stops the music at last and tucks the phone into her tote purse.
A Birkin, Manny notices with some admiration. Apparently, he's the kind of man who knows his expensive Birkin bags.
There's something familiar about her, but Manny can't place it. Maybe it's just that she's like him.
He stares at her, filled with an inchoate hunger.
So, I'm guessing y'all haven't figured out how this shit works yet, she says to them.
Her gaze rakes Bell, then Manny, and stops there, narrowing a little.
Oh, okay. Just you, then.
Manny nods, swallowing. Another like him.
I don't know anything. Do you?
He knows it sounds inane, but he can't think of anything else to ask. She raises her eyebrows.
Well, that depends on what you're asking. If you mean, have I suddenly started hearing crazy business in my head and seeing those white pigeon feather things all over my hood? Yeah. If you want to know why, I don't even know.
The woman shakes her head. I had to kill 3 patches of them just to get to the 3 train.
Pigeon feather things.
But Manny understands that she means the tendrils. To him, they look like sea creatures, but he can see the resemblance to feather shafts, too.
You people really are the worst drug dealers,
says the white woman, shaking her head,
just brazenly talking about your designer drugs.
In the distance, Manny can't tell if they're actually approaching or just happenstance. They can hear sirens.
That's it.
Manny straightens, setting his jaw. The black woman is staring at the white woman now.
You actually called the cops on these men?
For what? Walking in the park while black and Asian?
She lets out an incredulous laugh. By the time that laugh has faded, however, Manny's walked over to the white woman and snatched the phone from her hand.
Whoa,
says Bell, more startled than prohibitive. Manny ignores him. The woman yelps and draws breath to scream, but before she can, Manny steps in closer and wraps a hand around the lower half of her face, covering her mouth. The black woman utters a swift curse, but then backs up to where she can watch the 2 paths coming out of the woods. The white woman grabs for Manny's arm rather than trying to wrench away. It's exactly what Manny expected. She's clearly unwilling to back away from someone whom she regards as having no right to exist in public, let alone within her personal space. She isn't scared, not really. She assumed that he would not dare attack her. Well, then, it's the work of a moment for Manny to switch his grip to the woman's throat instead. Her eyes widen.
Don't scream, he says.
She inhales. In a sharp movement, Manny tightens his hand and turns them around, yanking the woman off balance and angling his body so that the couple on the grass won't see. Not that they're paying attention. To judge by their positions and the way they're moving, Manny suspects they're actually filming themselves having sex in public. No reason not to be careful, though. If they do happen to glance toward the group around the tulip tree rock, it will look like Manny's just standing close to the woman while they have an intimate talk. The woman freezes, scream taut, but unreleased in her throat tendons. Manny loosens his grip as soon as it's clear she's taken the hint. He only wants to keep her quiet, not cut off her air, and he needs to keep his grip gentle or he'll leave finger marks. There's an art to doing this. How does he know that? God! Once she's still,
Manny asks her conversationally, "Don't drug dealers usually kill snitches?" She inhales a little, her eyes locking onto his. Now she's scared. Manny smiles as, with his free hand, he thumbs through her phone. It's all fine and friendly. Just a little shakedown between friends. "I've always heard that about dealers," Manny continues as he searches through the phone's stored data directory. "Got it. Next, active apps. I mean, we are not drug dealers. But if we were, it doesn't make a lot of sense that you just stood there filming us. That just doesn't sound safe, does it? But I think you filmed us because you didn't think we were dealers, because we were just ordinary people going about our own business, and it bothered you to see us comfortable and unafraid. So now you've inserted yourself into something very dangerous." Hold still. She freezes at the whip crack of those last two words. This close, he can feel the tension in her body. Easy to tell she was shifting her weight, about to try to lunge away. Satisfied, Manny resumes, thumbing through her phone. Anyway, let's see. Ah, you're on Facebook. Live? He browses her settings. Guess not. And you don't have any backup apps logged in. He glances at the top of her Facebook profile and beams in delight. Martha! Martha Blemmons! The woman makes an unhappy sound around his hand. That's an incredibly pretty name, Martha. And Blemmons is such a unique spelling. I see you work at Eventflight. As a marketplace analyst? That sounds really important. Martha Blemmons is terrified now. Her hands have locked around Manny's wrist, but he can feel them trembling, the palms a little damp. Tears have begun trailing from one eye. She's so visibly on the brink of panic that Manny is honestly surprised when she manages to speak. "You can't hurt me," she says, her voice wavering. "You better not." Manny feels a great wave of sadness come over him. "I can hurt you, Martha," he confesses. "I know how. And it wouldn't be the first time I've hurt someone else. I think I've done that a lot." He knows this is true, suddenly. And he hates that this, out of the gray, undifferentiated morass that is his past, is the knowledge that's returned to him. Her pulse flutters fast against his palm. This will have traumatized her, he feels certain. It's a mugging without the mugging. She'll never sleep easily again in New York, never walk to work without looking over her shoulder. He's in her head now, waving at her from the little box of assumptions that she carries about certain kinds of people. The fact that she applied these assumptions preemptively means there's nothing he could have done to change them. But he still hates that he's just confirmed her stereotypes. The sound of sirens is fading. Either the police passed by on their way to something else, or they've parked and are headed this way on foot. Time to go. Manny lets go of Martha's throat, steps back, and, after wiping it carefully against his pants leg and holding only the rough edges of her decorative case, hands her phone back to her. She grabs it and stares at him, mute with shock. "Have a really nice day, Martha," he says, meaning it. But he has to add one more thing if they are to be safe from the danger she presents. He has to be more dangerous in her mind. So he says, "Hopefully we won't ever see each other again." Then he backs away, down one of the paths that leads away from where they last heard sirens. Belle is staring at him, though he moves to follow Manny after a moment. The black woman sighs, but falls in as well, and Manny turns to head up the hill with them. Martha stays where Manny's left her, not making a sound, and not turning to watch them leave. They're almost to the edge of the park, no cops so far, before the black woman finally says,
"I take it, you're Manhattan."
He blinks out of melancholy and turns to her. She's pulled some kind of breakfast bar out of her bag and is eating it.
"Yeah? How did you guess?" "Are you kidding? Dudes like you? Smart, charming, well-dressed, and cold enough to strangle you in an alley if we had alleys?"
She snorts to herself. While Manny tries not to let her see how much this assessment hurts him.
"Dime a dozen on Wall Street and at City Hall. Figured you'd be meaner, actually. The kind of dude who didn't stop at just threats."
"I haven't always," Manny thinks, in despair. Belle makes a sound that's somewhere between an audible swallow and a throat clearing.
"So you remembered who you were?"
When Manny frowns at him, he smiles. It's rueful and doesn't quite meet his eyes.
"I mean, you're back to being the bloke I met before.
The one with the edge." Manny wrestles with several responses before deciding,
"No. Don't sound too sure there, mate."
He isn't, but he doesn't want to talk about it. To distract himself, he considers the black woman and guesses,
"Queens?"
She gives him such a disgusted look that he immediately amends,
"Brooklyn."
This seems to mollify her.
"Yes, it also has the virtue of being my name, Brooklyn Thomason, Esquire, though I'm not practicing anymore. Went into politics instead."
Her name is actually Brooklyn, and she remembers herself, which means that whatever has happened to make them what they are, memory loss isn't part of the normal process.
"How did you know," he blurts, "how to find me? How did you know to play music? Why don't I know any of this?"
She regards him coolly, despite the sweat that dots her brow after steady uphill walking. They're circling around the park, Manny realizes. His spatial awareness is completely foiled by the trees, but he suspects they're heading south and will emerge from the park somewhere near Dyckman. He remembers seeing that on his phone's map.
"You are not from here, are you?"
she asks.
"No."
He stares at her, wanting to know how she knew that too. The bike salespeople at Penn Station seemed to think he was a local. She sees his confusion and sighs. He gets the fleeting impression that she doesn't like talking to him, though he can't tell why. Maybe it's personal, or maybe she dislikes men who jack up women on general principle.
"I don't know how I knew. I just feel it. That's been my whole day so far, doing and thinking stuff that doesn't make any sense just 'cause it feels right."
Manny lets out a slow breath to calm himself.
"Yeah, same."
Belle's calmer now, and his regional accent has faded back into generic Britishness.
"I'm glad I have no idea what you're talking about. It sounds, fraught."
Brooklyn snorts at this, though she then focuses on Manny again.
"I've heard something since I was a child," she admits. "Muttering, feelings, images, felt things too. Little twitches and sighs and touches. All for so long that I don't even really think about it anymore. For a while I talked back. Never told anybody they were love songs to the city. But not everybody needs to know everything."
Her expression has gone flat, and he understands then what she doesn't like. Not him, but the fact that she has to speak about something so obviously personal. He nods back, trying to convey that he won't use this against her. But she just shakes her head, annoyed at the situation regardless. That's when something about her scowl hits Manny. He stops in his tracks. She stops after another step or two, then turns back with visible reluctance. There's a held breath in her expression this time, as if she's bracing herself for something. That's his confirmation.
"Oh, wow," he says. "You're MC free."
"What?"
Belle stops too, staring at her.
"Oh shit, you are."
"I'm Brooklyn Thomason," she replies.
It's gentle but firm. "MC Free was my stage name 30 years ago and 30 pounds ago. These days, I'm on the city council. I got a JD and a 14-year-old and a side hustle renting out vacation property."
Then she sighs, relenting.
"But, yeah, that's who I used to be."
"My God," Belle says in a tone of naked reverence. "The greatest of the early female MCs. Lewisham was all over you back then.
I grew up on your music."
Brooklyn's expression turns faintly sour. "Every time somebody says that to me, I pop another gray hair. You notice I dye it now." Belle winces and takes the hint to get over it.
"Yeah, sorry. Shutting up."
They all shut up for a while, because the hill has winded them. On impulse, Manny lifts his eyes to the tree canopy as they walk. It's cooler here in the forest shadows than it is on the asphalt streets and concrete sidewalks. Strange to think, there are probably wild animals in this forest, like raccoons and maybe deer or coyotes. He's read that those are making a comeback in some areas of the city. But other kinds of animals abound here, too. How many other people besides Martha Blemons have been mugged here? How many beatings? How many stabbings? How many rapes? Whole villages of Lenape were driven away from the city and its immediate vicinity by the Dutch. How many of them died in the process? How much blood and fear has soaked into this old bedrock? "I am Manhattan," he thinks again, this time in a slow upwelling of despair. "Every murderer, every slave broker, every slumlord who shut off the heat and froze children to death, every stockbroker who got rich off war and suffering. It's only the truth. He doesn't have to like it, though." They reach Dyckman after a while. The clotting traffic on the street means that rush hour has started. School's out, sending packs of same-age children forth to flow along both sides of the street. No one's looking at Manny and company as they emerge from the park. If the police did respond to Martha's call, there's no sign of them anywhere nearby. Then again, given the Williamsburg, they probably didn't bother to come.
"So what now?" Manny asks.
Brooklyn sighs.
"No idea. But I'll tell you what, I'm pretty sure there's a reason all of this is happening all of a sudden."
She eyes him.
"You know the bridge thing is part of this, right?"
Manny stares at her. Belle looks from one to the other of them, incredulous.
"The Williamsburg? What, fell down because of..."
He gestures vaguely in the direction of the tulip tree rock.
"Those squiggly things? And that other woman?"
Brooklyn frowns at him.
"Other woman?" "The one that Mrs. Nosy Parker turned into for a moment. Before you showed up."
He shivers a little.
"Never seen anything creepier, except those horrid little white things."
Brooklyn shakes her head in confusion, and Manny has to explain. It's actually difficult to find the words for what they saw, though after a few attempts, he manages to get across that the woman Brooklyn saw was just temporary housing for someone or something else.
"She controls those things," he says, gesturing at the back of his neck,
while Brooklyn digests what he said.
"I'm sure of it. The ones on FDR Drive, too. Anything those tentacles touch."
"Something told me to avoid the FDR today.
Not that I usually drive anyway. Took the subway."
Brooklyn sighs.
"That's how I don't know, felt you? There was a crisis response meeting for city leaders up in Washington Heights.
I was about to head home, but something told me to take the train uptown instead. The something got stronger the closer I got to you.
Then there you were, in trouble.
There are 5 of us, Manny says. He watches Brooklyn start as she takes his meaning.
Oh, hell. You think the other 3 are in trouble, too?
She frowns, then shakes her head slowly.
Look, I'm glad I could help you, but I didn't sign on for an extra job. I got a kid, and my father is sick. You want to try and find him, go ahead. I have to get home.
Manny starts to speak to try to persuade her, and then something catches his attention from the corner of his eye. He follows it and finds himself looking across the street at a little bodega on the corner. Next to it is a laundromat that's been gracious enough to put a tiny rickety bench out front. An elderly man sits there with a small dog on a leash. He's busy chatting in Spanish with a woman who stands in the doorway of the laundromat. They're laughing about something. But the dog is watching Manny and company with a steady, fixed stare that does not at all feel like the gaze of an animal. Then Manny looks closer. Between its clawed toes, like bits of ghostly grass picked up on its last walk, are 6 gently waving white tendrils. Brooklyn sees it too.
Are you fucking kidding me?
Staring at the dog, his skin all over prickling, Manny says, it's what happened on FDR. The tendrils, anything that got close to them. Like a goddamn disease, Brooklyn breathes. Belle is staring at the dog, too. He's squinting a little as if the tendrils are hard to see. But then he grimaces and visibly shivers.
I saw that old fellow walking his dog earlier, when we were walking. If everybody who was in the park just now is, infected, then I imagine it'll be all over the city within a day or two.
They all fall silent for a moment, digesting this. The white things came off of that woman when I got rid of the others, Brooklyn says. She's hiding it well, but her confident facade has slipped a little at the sight of the dog. The dog makes this something insidious and ominous. She was only marinating in her own evil, nobody else's by the time we were done. Manny finds himself thinking about the wave of force that spread out toward the FDR in the wake of his little stunt with the cab. He has an idea of what it is now, the city's energy, dissipating outward in a circular wave once Manny no longer needed it in concentrated form. How far did that splash of energy go? He can't guess, but he remembers seeing it kill all the white tendrils that it touched. A powerful weapon, if Manny can figure out how to use it consistently. Manny turns to Brooklyn.
Look, I can't make you help me, but if I have to do this on my own, I'm going to need a crash course in how to be a New Yorker.
She blinks. Then there is another of those peculiar shifts in which the world doubles, and here in the other weirder New York. His perspective is suddenly wider, higher. Macro scale instead of micro. And here in this other realm, she looms over him, vast and sprawling, wildly patchwork and dense, not just older, but bigger. Stronger in many ways. Her arms and core are thick with muscled neighborhoods that each have their own rhythms and reputations. Williamsburg. Hasidim enclave, an artist haven turned hipster ground zero.
Bed-Stuy, do or die.
Crown Heights, where now the only riots are over seats at brunch.
Her jaw is tight with the stubborn ferocity of Brighton Beach's old mobsters
and the Rockaways' working-class holdouts against the brutal inevitability of rising seas. But there are spires at Brooklyn's heart, too. Perhaps not as grand as his own. And maybe some of hers are actually the airy, fanciful amusement park towers of Coney Island. But all are just as shining, just as sharp. She is Brooklyn, and she is mighty.
and in this instant, he cannot help but love her, stranger or not. Then she is just a middle-aged woman again, with a shining sharp grin.
I guess I could help you with that, she concedes. I guess I have to, if this shit is spreading. But there ain't no one way to be a part of this city.
She slips into and out of the vernacular like changing purses, effortless, and with ever-perfect fit. Manny soaks it all in, getting a feel for the cadence trying to keep up. Takes most people a year at least to really feel the city's call. The city's call, he hears. Her nose moves when she says it, as if there's a W in the word. The accent layers extra consonants into words and extra meaning onto thoughts.
I'll give it my all, he replies, deliberately adding a W to the last word and testing out its new flavor. It's not quite right. Brooklyn instead of Manhattan.
But still better than the Midwestern accent that currently infests his language and which he now consciously decides to shed. It does not belong here.
Let me call my family, she says at last. Tell them I'll be late home.
Then let's go find a coffee shop or...
And then they both feel it. In the other world, Brooklyn and Manhattan step back, to the degree that entities with foundations instead of feet can do so, to make room for the explosive, brilliant skyline burst of another of their number. In the people world, they look at each other and murmur in unison, both slipping into a perfect South Indian English accent.
Oh, come on. The shape of the earth is non-Euclidean. All that means is that you use different math. Don't get it twisted.
Belle stares at them.
That is the creepiest thing I've seen today.
Barring the alien mind control spaghetti.
Okay, Brooklyn says. Crosstown bus, then. There's a stop a few blocks from here.
Manny nods. He knows instinctively that they have to go, though he does not yet have enough of a sense of the city to fully understand what he's feeling.
Where?
Queens,
Brooklyn says.
Shit, that was Queens.
Of course. Manny takes a deep breath, then turns to Belle.
I think you better head back home. Sorry, but this is going to get weird. Weirder.
Belle rocks back on his heels and lets out a whistled breath.
And as things have been entirely too weird for me already, yes, I agree. Go with God, and so on.
He steps back and waves.
Do try not to get eaten by the spaghetti people, though. Even now, you're not the worst roommate I've ever had.
Manny half smiles and nods farewell, then turns to pace Brooklyn as she heads in the direction of the crosstown bus stop. He waits until they're a block or so away from Belle, and well away from the tendril-infested dog before saying,
So is there a reason we aren't taking a cab?
Oh, not sure what to tell the cabbie, Brooklyn says.
Queens is huge. We're not gonna just feel the force at random there. We'll take the crosstown bus to where we can pick up the 7. Mass Transit led me to you, so I'm hoping that'll happen again there. Since I'm apparently doing this now. So much for going home.
Okay. It's frustratingly nebulous, but Manny understands precisely why she's walking fast and why they aren't waiting for these peculiar new instincts of theirs to provide some more specific, concrete direction. The jittering, rapidly rising sense of urgency within him is undeniable. Queens is out there becoming its person, and that person is in danger. If they're going to do her any good at all, they need to hurry. Except, well,
Manny's pretty sure they're already too late.
Chapter 3.
Our Lady of Staten Island.
It's time.
Islyn Houlihan is at the St. George terminal of the Staten Island ferry, trembling. She's been here for 20 minutes, trembling. There are open seats because it's early enough in the day, just before the start of rush hour, that the ferry won't be anywhere near full. But she's opted to pace in front of the glass window wall instead of sitting. The better to tremble while she paces. The terminal is mostly just a big, brightly lit room where a few hundred people can assemble. There's nothing that should be scary about it. Its walls are lined with ads for movies Islyn isn't planning to see, and makeup she probably won't ever wear. The people standing or sitting around her are hers. Her people. She feels this instinctively, even though her mind resists when her gaze skates over Asian faces, or her ears pick up a language that probably isn't Spanish, but also definitely isn't English.
Quechua.
Her strange, newer senses whisper. But she doesn't want to hear it. They aren't bothering her, though. And there are plenty of normal people around. So there's no good reason for her to be as terrified as she is. Terror doesn't always happen for a good reason. There's a garbled announcement over the PA system, and abruptly, the big doors along one side of the room open up. Beyond them is an outdoor pier where the 2:30 p.m. ferry is preparing to leave. The 100 or so people cattling around the terminal begin moving toward it, and Islyn belatedly tries to stumble after them. From the first step, it's wrong. Everything feels wrong. Staten Islanders normally take the ferry away in the mornings, leaving the island quieter, emptier. It's afternoon now, though. All over the city, Manhattan is always the city, thousands of SI denizens are growing antsy with the end of the workday, shifting in their trendy seats, thinking wistfully of a place where there are still forests and ranches, and mostly unspoiled beaches, and where most families live in discreet houses and own cars like normal people. What Islyn is doing is leaving the island at a time when most want to return to it. She is swimming upriver, reversing the polarity. The wrongness of it presses against her skin. Her hair follicles tingle. She tries to keep her feet moving anyway, use the flow of the crowd to counter the wrongness. Through the doors, outside onto the pier, moving toward the boat. She's choosing her own direction in life. The wrongness is just her imagination. Or maybe something else is happening. Maybe it's not the hard gust of wind off the harbor that's making her steps drag. Maybe it's her own leaden feet and bedrock legs. Maybe the scalp tingling isn't her hair streaming in the wind. Maybe it's the island, her island, pulling at her in warning, in fear, in love. Or maybe it's an incipient panic attack. She tries to fight it off and gets as far as the ramp that leads on to the ferry. John F. Kennedy reads the ferry's name, placarded on the wheelhouse. This is the name of her tormentor. Did JFK fear anything before somebody, the mob, according to her father, a crazy man, according to her mother, shot out his brains? If she gets on this boat, she'll be going to a city where things like that happen on a regular basis. People kill each other on SI, too, all the time. But it's different in the city. Everything is different there. If she gets on this boat, she will come back different. Someone nudges her hard. Hey, blocking traffic. If she gets on this boat, will she come back wrong? Someone else puts a hand on her upper arm. It's closely packed enough on the ramp that the person actually jostles her, grunting out a curse as the crowd shoves them forward and causes them to squish Islyn's right breast. It doesn't hurt, and it's obviously an accident. But when she glances around to see who's touching her, her gaze skates over skin so black that it's like looking into a magic eight ball before the little plastic thing inside bobs up to say, "Now, panic!" Her thoughts ignite. "Get away, get off me, don't touch me, get me out of here!" And her body contracts without any conscious input. Now she is moving against the flow, with the island's wishes, though, at last, lurching from one stranger's horrifying touch to another, and wondering the whole time, who's screaming with such an ear-piercing pitch? Only belatedly does she recognize her own voice. People around her freeze or jerk away from the crazy lady, but they're still too close, crushing her. She writhes around them, already turned toward the glass doors. "Whoa, whoa, whoa," someone says, and it sounds like they're going to try and stop her. Who is it? She can't let that black eye touch her again. It's a white hand that catches a wrist. She doesn't see its owner, but she rakes her nails down flesh before yanking free. Someone else screams, and then the crowd parts, and finally, she's free. She runs back through the glass doors, through the terminal. There's a cop coming out of the single-stall family bathroom, still fastening his belt, and with a folded copy of the Post under one arm. He yells after her, and Island knows she should stop. Her father has told her and told her. Only criminals run. And she scratched somebody, isn't that assault? She's a criminal now. They'll take her to Rikers Island, which is a completely different and much worse island than her own. They will make her leave SI. They'll force her onto a police boat, and they'll never let her come back. But no one can make a city do anything it doesn't want to, says someone close by in a puzzled tone. And Island looks left to find a woman running beside her. She's so startled that she stumbles in mid-run. The woman quickly puts out a hand to steady her, and they both jog to a halt. She's a little surprised to find herself well outside the terminal, between two of the dozen-odd bus platforms that edge up to it. Passing strangers stare, and she flinches away from their gazes, but the breeze has worked to break her out of the cycle of panic. She swallows, beginning to calm. "There, there," says the woman, who's holding her shoulders now. She smiles comfortingly, and she's comforting to look at. White blonde hair in a pixie cut, surrounding a pale gray-eyed face. She's wearing sandals that clearly don't impede her ability to sprint. Her white jeans are probably stylish. Her white blouse definitely is. The woman speaks while Island stares at her in breathless dumbness. "That's better, isn't it? Nothing scary here. No boats, no water, no illegal immigrants touching you. No peer pressure trying to make you cross the harbor. I don't blame you at all, by the way. Manhattan is very pretty, but he's full of bees." The nonsense of this monologue breaks the remnants of Island's panic. Manhattan's an it, isn't it? Not a he. And bees? She giggles, despite herself. But before she can process the words further, her phone starts ringing. She jumps violently. The woman pets her shoulder, incongruously, has been petting Island since they met, as if determined to single-handedly replace the memory of all those strangers' touches with just her own. But weirdly, this makes Island feel better. She grabs her phone and sees Matthew Houlihan, Daddy.
"Where are you?"
he asks when she answers.
"Just out running errands," she says.
She's never been good at lying, and her father is excellent at figuring out when she's trying it. So she always makes sure there's some truth in whatever she tells him. She did stop at the grocery store on the way to the ferry station to buy garlic.
"Got something at the grocery store. Now shopping a little. Everything okay at work?"
It's always better to get him focused on himself rather than her. He sighs and takes the bait.
"Just getting sick of these immigrants," he says.
He's always careful to use acceptable words when he's on the job, rather than the words he says at home.
That's how cops mess up, he has explained to her. They don't know how to keep home words at home and work words at work. These people. Had to arrest a guy this morning. Just sitting in his car, right? I figured he was dealing. Didn't find anything. But he's got no ID, right? So I run his tag and tell him we're calling ICE. Just to shake him up, see? He was acting all smooth. He says he's Puerto Rican, they're citizens. Calls me all kinds of shit. Starts talking about getting on that Twitter to complain about profiling.
She can practically hear her father's eye roll.
Damn straight, I profiled him. Right into a cell for assault.
Making a conversation of his rants is a skill Aislinn has long since perfected. Pick a point in his last sentence, ask a question related to it, tune him out again. Only by doing this has she been able to make space for her own thoughts over the years.
Assault, Daddy? Are you okay?
He sounds startled, and also pleased, which is good.
Oh, no, Apple. Don't worry about you, old man. If he had assaulted me, I'd have kicked his ass all over his beanie head. Nah, I just needed something to run him in on.
She can actually hear his shrug. Then he chuckles.
Said he was listening to New Age music on his car radio to relax, if you can believe that. Ah, these people.
Aislinn nods absently while he rants, peering around and trying to remember which bus she's supposed to take back home from the ferry. As she does so, though, her eyes catch on the strange woman, who's still standing there with a hand on Aislinn's shoulder. Aislinn can barely feel the hand. Her nerves don't seem to register its weight or the warmth that should be there. By contrast, her other arm, the one grabbed by the black man on the ferry ramp, still tingles.
Did he do something to her? Were there maybe drugs on his hands? And are they seeping through her skin?
Her father has warned her that some drugs work this way. But what has caught her attention is what the woman in white clothing is doing, now and again, as she stands beside Aislinn. With her free hand, she's touching other people as they pass on the sidewalk. Not all of them, just a person here and a person there. And just a light, friendly pat on the shoulder. They don't seem to notice. But when one man stops to tie his shoe, Aislinn sees something odd. Where the woman has touched him, there's a thin, pale nub poking through the cloth of his t-shirt. As Aislinn watches, the nub lengthens and thickens, growing until it wavers above the man's shoulder 6 inches long or so, and drifting with the breeze. It's white, about the thickness of yarn. Okay, that's super weird. It's also weird that the woman with the white blonde hair has chosen to remain so close while Aislinn's on what's obviously a private phone call. Maybe she's just trying to make sure Aislinn's okay. Her father is winding down, but just when Aislinn thinks she's free, he adds, anyway, I just heard an alert over the channel, and well, I thought about you. Aislinn tenses. The channel is what her father calls police radio.
They said a girl with your description caused a disturbance and assaulted somebody.
This, too, is habit. Aislinn chuckles it off. She knows she sounds nervous. She always sounds nervous. Aren't there a lot of brown-haired 30-year-old white girls out there? He chuckles, too, and she relaxes.
Yeah. And I can't see you cutting somebody with a knife.
A knife, she thinks. But her nails are pretty long.
Or getting on that ferry.
Inadvertently, Aislinn stiffens. The woman in white pats her shoulder again, murmuring something soothing, but it doesn't help as much this time.
I could get on the ferry, Aislinn blurts. If I wanted.
His chuckle annoys her now.
You?
That city would eat you up, Apple.
Then, as if he's heard her affront, or cares about it, his voice changes to a more soothing tone. You're a good girl, Aislinn, and the city isn't a place for good people.
What have I always told you?
She sighs. Everything that happens everywhere else happens here, too. But at least here, people try to be decent.
Yeah. And what else?
Stay where you're happy.
Right. The city ever becomes a place where you are happy, go there.
But as long as this is it, stay home. Nothing wrong with staying home. Yes. She has told herself this every day of her adult life, to console herself for being a grown woman who still lives at home with her parents. It's a lie. She's lonely and ashamed, and she hasn't given up hope for a life of excitement and sophistication somewhere and sometime. But this is the sort of lie that she needs, especially in the wake of her disastrous attempt to board the ferry.
Yeah, thanks, Daddy.
She knows he's smiling.
Tell your mom I'm gonna be home late. Unrest means paperwork.
These fucking people. He sighs, as if the Puerto Rican man sat around new aging while brown just to make him late for dinner, and hangs up. Aislinn puts her phone away, then finally pulls her purse back up to her shoulder to compose herself, or she tries to. The strange woman is still holding Aislinn's shoulder, although she's frowning a little, as if wondering how her hand got there. Aislinn looks at the woman's hand, too. Is something the matter?
What?
Oh! The woman finally removes her hand and smiles. It's a little strained.
Everything's fine. I'm just going to have to do this the hard way, apparently.
Then her smile broadens, more genuine. But I know I'm right about you. For the first time, Aislinn begins to feel uneasy. The woman doesn't look scary, but there's something about her that's a little off.
Right about what?
Well, for one thing, I haven't been able to claim you as my own. The woman folds her arms and turns to face away from the ferry station, toward the cluster of tall office buildings and high-rise apartments that dominate this side of the island.
You have the right inclination. But even though the city just rebirthed itself this morning, you're already closely enough bound with the essence of this place to keep me from pulling you in.
You even smell like a city now, and not an ordinary human being. She shrugs. Aislinn puzzles over all of this, then surreptitiously angles her head to sniff at her pits. The woman has begun murmuring to herself as she stares at the paltry skyline of St. George.
Haven't had this much trouble since London.
Usually it's easier to isolate the vectors. City morphology defies predictability, of course. But there are epigenetic manifestations, metabolic fluxes that should follow through in a perceptible way. It's this city, though.
She shakes her head. Scowling. Too many New Yorkers are New York.
Its acculturation quotient is dangerously high. Abruptly, the woman's head swivels to face Aislinn. That's what it looks like, a swivel, as if the woman's neck muscles are motors or pulleys or something else mechanical. She looks thoughtful.
Do you know who you are?
Aislinn looks around again. Which bus platform was it? There are so many and they all look alike. Maybe she should just pick one and start walking toward it. Because something about this woman has made Aislinn think she needs an exit strategy.
Sorry, but I don't think...
There's a moment. In retrospect, she will recall this with great clarity. When Aislinn feels the woman's attention shift. Before now, the woman in the white outfit has been not quite present.
Underneath her comforting smiles, there is a distance and a going through the motions-ness, if that is a thing. All at once, however, the woman becomes here. She becomes more. Now she looms. She's only a few inches taller than Aislinn. But within those inches, she towers. She smiles, and buried in the woman's shadow, Aislinn feels small and forgotten and terribly, hopelessly alone. But in almost the same moment, that other feeling rises within her. It's the feeling that hit her this morning while she was in the middle of washing the dishes from breakfast and thinking about Scotswoman's Secret, the romance novel she'd been reading the night before. She had been fantasizing a little, maybe, about being a proud, strong-willed nobleman from the Highlands who decides to start discreetly sleeping with the handsome foreign stablehand who isn't black, but whose penis nearly is, except for the tip. When it gets excited, that part is pink, and Aislinn isn't sure whether it's creative license on the author's part or something that's actually possible. Then, while scrubbing crusted eggs off a pan and visualizing the previous chapter's sex scene, Aislinn began to hear shouting in her mind. These were crude, vulgar, angry shouts. Shouts so suffused with rage that had she heard them with her ears, she would have never been able to make out the words. Incoherent anger. In her mind, though, she had not only heard the words, but known them and felt them. She'd wanted to fight as the speaker of those words was fighting somewhere. Somehow she'd known that. The vicarious aggression had suffused her with a rage so terrible, so overwhelming, that she had to go to her room and destroy a pillow. That wasn't like her. Not at all. She never fought back. Yet this morning, she had ripped that pillow to shreds, then risen from foamy carnage filled with a powerful compulsion to go to the city. So powerful had she felt in the wake of that rage that for the first time in years, she actually tried it. Only to fail. Again. Now, however, Aislinn feels that strange, angry strength stirring inside her again. Who is this woman to stand over her so? She doesn't belong here, Aislinn knows. Aislinn might be afraid of the city, but SI is her island, and she will not be loomed over on her home ground. But before Aislinn can open her mouth to stammer out some devastating variant of please leave before I call the police, the woman in white leans down to grin into her face. You are Staten Island, she says. Aislinn starts. It isn't the words that surprise her, but the fact that someone else has said them. The woman laughs softly, eyes flicking back and forth over Aislinn's face, as if drinking in her shock. The woman continues. The forgotten one, and the despised one when they bother to remember. The borough no one, including its own, thinks of as real New York. And yet here you are. Somehow, despite their neglect and contempt, you've developed enough distinctiveness of culture to survive rebirth. And this morning, you heard the rest of the city calling out to you, didn't you? Aislinn takes a step back. Just for personal space reasons. I didn't. But she did. She did. She heard the city's raw, defiant demand, and some part of her tried to respond to it. That's how she ended up at the ferry station. She trails off mid-sentence because she doesn't actually need to say the words. The woman in white knows Aislinn as surely as Aislinn knows her island. Oh, you poor thing, the woman says, her expression shifting from avid to tender so quickly that Aislinn's anger vanishes. Now all she feels is a rapidly growing unease in this woman's presence. You can't help sensing some of the truth.
But you're alone amid the vastness of it all, aren't you? Just one little alga, floating amid a green sea of them. Convinced of your unimportance, even as you threaten 100 billion realities.
I could pity you, if not for that threat.
Aislinn stares back at her. Alga? Is that another language? It sounds like the singular of algae.
God, did this woman just call her a microbe?
And now you have to live that truth, the woman continues. She's not looming anymore, not as much anyhow. But the air of patronizing concern that she radiates isn't much better. Aislinn stares at her, still trying to figure out whether she should be insulted. The woman leans closer.
That's why you're afraid of the ferry. Half the people on this island absolutely dread crossing that water every day. They know that what awaits them on the other end isn't the power and glamour we can see from here, but bad jobs and worse pay, and prancing, manned-bunned baristas who turn up their noses at making just a simple goddamn coffee, and prissy chink bitches who barely speak English but make 7 figures gambling with your 401k. And feminists, and Jews, and trannies, and Negroes, and liberals. Libtards everywhere, making the world safe for every kind of pervert. And the other half of the island is the baristas, and chinks, and feminists. Ashamed they can't afford to live there and leave Staten Island for good.
You are them, Aislinn. You carry the fear and resentment of 500,000 people. So is it any wonder that part of you wants to flee screaming? By this point, the woman is doing more than looming. She is waving her arms, stage whispering as loud as a shout, flaring her nostrils, wild-eyed. And Aislinn has reacted the way she always does when someone bigger and louder starts yelling. She's hunched in on herself, leaning away as the woman leans in and holding her purse strap with both hands as if it is a shield. She can think of only one thing to say as the woman runs out of words and falls silent with a fleck of bubbled spittle on her lips. Aislinn blurts,
I don't have a 401k.
The woman in white tilts her head, looms less. What?
You said,
she swallows. She can't speak that word here at the ferry station. It's a home word.
You said, Asian women take your 401k, but I don't have one of those.
The woman in white stares at her. It is the first time, maybe, that she has heard something crazier than herself. And after a moment, she bursts out laughing. It is an awful laugh. Delighted, but awful. High-pitched, too sharp, with an edge that reminds Aislinn of the mean girls back in high school, or maybe a cartoon witch's cackle. Passers-by along the sidewalk flinch from that laugh, then stare at the woman as if they've heard a warning from beyond. And yet, after a moment, Aislinn finds herself grinning too, just a little, then giggling, as the tension of the moment dissolves. The laughter is more than infectious. Aislinn is infected, bonding by catharsis. All at once, she and the woman in white are laughing together, so hard that Aislinn's eyes water with the force of her own voice, and so richly that for a beautiful moment, all of Aislinn's troubles feel as nothing. It's as if they've been friends for years. When the laughter fades, the woman in white dabs at one eye with an air of regret.
Oh, my. Oh, that was lovely. I have to admit, I'll miss this universe when everything is said and done. It's hideous, but not without its small joys.
Aislinn is still grinning, high on her own endorphins.
Do you ever say anything, you know, normal?
Not if I can avoid it.
And with a little sigh, the woman offers a hand to Aislinn.
But I want to help you.
Please say you'll let me help you.
It's automatic to take a helping hand.
Aislinn frowns, though.
What do I need help with?
This whole process.
I've watched your kind go through it hundreds of times at this point, and it's always fraught.
I like you, Aislinn, little island. And it's terrible. What will happen to you if that primary avatar finally wakes up? He's a monster. I want to save you from him.
Through the lingering, head-clearing relief of her earlier laughing fit, it is obvious to Aislinn that the woman is a crazy person.
Crazy people are mostly in the city, she's always thought. Homeless druggies and rapists who wear ratty dreadlocks and, she supposes, have sores from all the lice and STDs. The woman is well-dressed and clean, but there is a high manic gleam in her gaze, and her bright, cheerful voice sounds false. No one is ever that happy. She's clearly not from around here. Maybe she's an immigrant, too. Legal, of course. Maybe she's a Canadian who's been driven mad by the cold and socialized medicine. Still, this is a crazy person whom Aislinn finds herself liking. More importantly, the woman has said that she wants to help Aislinn, and somehow she seems to know about the strange voices in Aislinn's head and the stranger compulsion that drove her to the ferry station. It makes Aislinn feel more sympathetic than she ordinarily would be. So she sticks out her hand for the woman to shake.
Okay, then.
And then she trails off, remembering that the woman knows her name already.
How?
Staten Aislinn, the woman fills in, and giggles as if that is not a joke that 1,000 people have made to Aislinn over the course of her lifetime. Not for the last time does she regret her parents' choice to use an Americanization of Aislinn rather than its softer Irish pronunciation. The woman then takes Aislinn's hand and pumps it too vigorously.
Yes, pleased to meet you is appropriate, yes? We're both composite entities for whom the boundaries of space-time and flesh have meaning. Let's be besties.
Okay. The woman gives Aislinn's hand another pump, and then practically flings her hand away.
Now, since you seem to be of a sympathetic nature, let's get started on temporarily saving this local node of your consensus reality from existential annihilation, why don't we?
Well, I really need to get home.
Wait, what?
Annihilation is what took a moment to process.
You know about the bridge incident?
Like Woman in White, this has already achieved capital letter status in Aislinn's mind.
Of course, but...
The woman is turned back toward the Manhattan skyline, which arcs over the roof of the ferry station. The bridge in question is not visible from this vantage, but backwash from the incident has affected the whole tri-state area all day. Even as they stand there, a trio of military planes shoops past overhead, angling to circle the East River. The woman is bouncing a little on the balls of her feet.
You know what made the bridge fall? She says to Aislinn.
Me?
I did that. It was an accident, mind you. I was aiming for that little shit, the primary.
Her smile vanishes as quickly as it appeared.
Cities always fight when I come for them, but usually it's fair. Strength against strength, as it should be. But he actually threw concepts at me. I had no idea your kind had advanced to the point of using energized abstract macro constructs in combat.
Who expects microbes to go nuclear?
That was when I knew the time for stealth had passed.
Aislinn is staring at the woman, all her unease forgotten, amid shock and horror.
Terrorist!
Her mind cries and rejects.
Terrorists are bearded Arab men who mutter in guttural languages and want to rape virgins. This woman is just crazy. So she can't really be the person who broke the bridge. But she's possibly crazy enough to be dangerous. Aislinn decides to play along until she can get someplace safe.
Okay.
The woman in white's head swivels back to her.
I was asleep, she explains. The bulk of me was, that is. Never needed more than a fraction of myself to function in this realm before now. But conditions are right, and I've gained a true foothold at last.
She drapes an arm around Aislinn's shoulders again, before Aislinn can find a polite way to pull away.
There's five of you, you see, besides the primary. Five potential allies. Five weaknesses I can exploit.
The things coming out of the woman's mouth keep almost making sense. Aislinn almost understands. But finally, she shakes her head in frustration.
Primary what? Primary avatar. Help me find him, and then you'll be free.
Free? But I'm not... The woman has begun to walk, pulling Aislinn along. They're headed toward the bus that Aislinn needs, astonishingly. So Aislinn still can't bring herself to shake off the woman's arm.
Free? You're not. Right now, you're part of him.
Well, that's wrong.
All of you are part of each other, I think. That's the best way I can explain it. This algal colony, this microbial mat, has nuclei. No. Wait. All of your kind have souls. Ugh, that's a bad analogy. Well, six of you are more in charge than the rest, and those six are highly attuned to one another. Naturally, which means that finding one of you will help me find the rest of you.
She grins all teeth.
That one, in particular.
They've reached the bus and stopped before its open doors. It won't pull away for another 3 minutes, according to the clock on Aislinn's phone. Aislinn has begun to worry, however, that the woman in white will want to ride with her. Or even accompany her home. She tries to think of excuses to give the woman for why this cannot be.
Now head on back home, the woman says to Aislinn's great relief. I've got other business to take care of.
But until we meet again, here's a thing you need to consider. The woman leans close for a conspiratorial whisper. Aislinn just manages not to twitch away.
Why did the others leave you unprotected?
The question feels like a slap. In its wake, Aislinn is stung, then numb.
What?
Well, I've managed to locate nearly all of you by now. The woman extends her free hand and examines her nails. They're very long and curved. The Bronx is a borough of angry, suspicious people who expect betrayal. She's canny, and will take some planning to approach. Manhattan rolled up on top of a taxi and introduced himself to me quite boldly. Typical. Brooklyn, full of attitude and arrogance, came to his rescue when I tried to introduce myself back. And that damnable Sao Paulo is still here somewhere. The rude fellow!
He must be guarding the primary from me.
As Aislinn tries to process this,
there are five of you.
The woman slides her needle further under the skin.
But no one has come to rescue or guard you. Manhattan and Brooklyn make powerful allies as they work together to track down the Bronx and Queens.
But they haven't thought about you. Not even once. Aislinn stares back, understanding at last. Five of them, plus some sixth, who is primary.
She is Staten Island, and they are the other boroughs plus New York itself. And are they like her, these other strangers? Do they feel the needs of thousands, hear the voices of millions in their heads? She wants to meet them, ask them questions like, how do you get your burrow to shut up? And is it really my friend, or am I just that lonely? But she has not found them because she chickened out of taking the ferry. Even if she had made it to Manhattan, how would she have located them? If Manhattan and Brooklyn found each other, there must be a way. Some kind of city sonar or something, which would have activated if she'd tried to go to them. Without that effort on her part, however, the sonar has remained quiescent. Well, why can't they come to her instead? It's inconvenient, she reminds herself. Coming to Staten Island is always inconvenient for people in the city. Yes, but this is important, isn't it? They know the city has five boroughs, damn it. And if they've chosen not to look for her, who's gonna believe you? Her father's voice shouts from memory. Who's gonna help you? Nobody gives a shit. You don't fucking matter. Not words ever shouted at her, but Aislinn absorbed them anyway, and now they are wrapped under her bones, a contamination as deep and toxic as lead. She can no more shake off the visceral belief that she doesn't matter than she can her fear of the city. I don't think they meant to forget you, mind, says the woman. They'll get around to remembering eventually, and then they'll come. But they hate taking the ferry. So slow and inconvenient. There's the Verrazano, but it's so expensive. What kind of borough makes itself so inaccessible? Didn't that Jew fellow, the one who sang jazz with all those black people, call New York a visitor's place? But not this part of it. He mentioned Yonkers of all things, but left this entire borough out of the song. Staten Island, always the afterthought. Aislinn sits there, hearing the words and hating them and knowing the truth in them. She doesn't fucking matter. Her island doesn't fucking matter. The others have forgotten her when she needs them. Bridges are falling and everything is terrible, but she must find her own path to safety alone. Oh no, what's that face? The woman in white pulls away and grips Aislinn's shoulders in a sisterly way. What's this sadness? Don't worry. They might have abandoned you, but I'm here. And just look. She turns Aislinn around again, cheerfully manhandling her, and then points over her shoulder at the doorway of the ferry station, which Aislinn ran through in a panic not 20 minutes before. What am I supposed to... Then Aislinn sees it. On the metal sill of the door, curling out from a crack in the old painted metal, is the most peculiar thing. It looks like a fern frond, or a very long petal from an exotic flower. It's so white that it looks translucent, unearthly in its beauty. What is that? Think of it as a camera, she says. If you want, or a microphone. If you ever need me, and you see something like that around, just speak to it. See something, say something, right? I'll hear and come running. It's more craziness. The woman cannot possibly see and hear through a flower. Aislinn's got to get home to help her mother make dinner. So very gently, she pushes the woman's hands off her shoulders. All right, she says. But she likes the woman. It's nice to have a new friend, even if that friend is crazy. But she should at least know that friend's name. But before I go, what should I call you? The woman tilts her head, grimacing. You won't like my name, she says. It's foreign. Very hard to pronounce. I've told it to a few of your people, and they've just mangled it. Definitely from Canada, Aislinn decides.
Let me try it anyway.
All right, then. I'll need to whisper it in your ear, though. The time is coming when I'll be able to shout my name across the firmament, and all will know its sound. But for now, I'm only a whisper in this world. Are you ready? The bus driver is walking toward them, yawning and scratching himself. Isla needs to wrap this up.
Sure, go ahead.
The woman leans close and whispers into Island's ear a word that tolls throughout her skull, like the most dire of great bells, shaking her bones enough that she stumbles and falls to her knees. The world blurs. Her skin prickles and itches and grows hot all over, as if burned by the wind of the words passing. Then someone else is crouched before her.
Ma'am?
It's the bus driver. Aislinn blinks and looks around. She's in front of the bus she needs to take home. How did she get here? Was there someone else here just now? The driver asks,
Ma'am, do you need me to call 911?
No.
Aislinn shakes her head, trying to convey that she's all right.